Auhea o ko e toka aha. Ina he kuleana I mua o keia aha ho o kolo kolo ki e ki e hanahana o ka moku aina o Hawaii. E nau e mai e maliu mai I lohe ia kaleo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. E noho I lalo. Please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-17-638, State v. Alkire. Arguing for petitioner, Mr. Richard Holcomb. Arguing for respondent, Mr. Don Fudo.
All right, good morning, Mr. Holcomb and Mr. Fudo. Are you both ready to proceed today? All right, Mr. Holcomb, you reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Fudo will give you a warning with 6 minutes to go. Please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court. If it may please the court, my name is Richard Holcomb. I am here on behalf of the petitioner, Lisa Alkire. Absent the court wishing me to proceed otherwise, I would like to start with the first issue raised in the petition, which would be the Tachibana issue. Specifically, as a matter of first impression, we have asked this court to hold that when a suppression hearing is consolidated with trial, that the defendant be properly admonished, that they would have the right to testify for the purpose of the suppression hearing without that testimony being used against them to determine guilt or innocence.
What is the harm here?
Okay. So, had Miss Alkire did not testify at all. Had she been properly admonished, she could have testified for the purpose of the suppression hearing.
And then what happened to the suppression hearing? Didn't the court grant the motion for suppression without her testimony?
In part, he granted. He did not grant the reasonable suspicion and probable cause issues that we had.
Right, but how would her testimony? Okay, so you're saying that she could have testified that she wasn't swerving.
She could have testified to a number of factual discrepancies and had the court then evaluate who to believe or what facts that they chose to believe.
But did you raise the fact that the court erroneously denied that aspect of the motion to suppress?
Did I raise in my appellate briefing, did I raise that the suppression motion was wrongfully decided? No.
To this court?
No, I did not.
So, in other words, if there's no challenge to the ruling, then I'm not sure how your challenge to the lack of the advisory would make a difference.
Okay. So our position is that had Ms. Alkire been properly advised, and then she would have nothing to lose by testifying in the suppression hearing, she could have then decided as a strategic matter whether or not to allow that suppression testimony to also be consolidated, whether or not to then testify perhaps separately for the purpose of trial, touching on whatever issues that she had felt were important, or alternatively said, I don't want the testimony used at all in my trial. And so we believe that the important part of what we are saying here is that the purpose of this Tachibana colloquy is to ensure that the information conveyed by the judge has been understood by the defendant and that the defendant's decision not to testify has been made with an understanding of the defendant's rights. And we do not believe that the normal Tachibana colloquy is sufficient to inform the defendant of the scope of her rights when we consolidate that trial with the suppression.
Mr. Holcomb, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but could you clarify what you want on remand? In other words, would you pursue a combined motion to suppress and trial again, or would it be your choice to separate them and have a hearing on the motion to suppress before the trial?
Well, I'll give you the lawyer answer, Judge. I would consult with my client and let her decide. as to whether to do that.
Mr. Holcomb, what about the Rule 48 issue? The trial court commenced trial within the 6 months, but you believe that's not adequate. What's your position on that issue?
So that's correct, Your Honor. The trial court did start trial, and the threshold question that this court would have to address is whether the protections of both Rule 48 and or constitutional speedy trial rights apply despite the fact that trial had started. And since we filed the opening brief, this court, and forgive me if I'm mispronouncing the defendant's name, had decided State versus Vicenton. And in that case, this court, Justice Pollack writing, had found that a protracted pretrial period can hinder the accurate determination of a case as evidence dissipates as well as cause anxiety and hardship to a defendant awaiting the disposition of criminal charges. Thus, the Hawaii and U.S. constitutions and our court rules grant an accused the right to a prompt adjudication. And that's what we are after, a prompt adjudication. However, that quotation goes on to say, and a case generally must be dismissed if a defendant is held to answer for a period exceeding a prescribed time limit or an unreasonable amount of time without a trial ensuing. So the threshold question for this court, we believe as a matter of first impression, would be to determine whether once we commence trial that these protections continue to protect a defendant against the anxiety, the...
How do you respond to the plain language of the rule? In other words, the plain language of the rule says dismiss the charge with or without prejudice in its discretion if trial is not commenced within 6 months. So the right is conferred by the statute, by the rule. So is it a rule-based argument or a constitutionally-based argument or both? What would be the basis for your argument that that language should not either be applied or read as it would appear to be?
Okay, I have attempted to raise both. I don't know how successfully, but our position is as to the plain language of that rule, the rule would clearly contemplate a meaningful commencement.
You don't think you got a meaningful? I mean, I think the argument, you cited a California case, I believe, where there was, you know, where it was perfunctory. I mean, was this a perfunctory commencement of case of the trial?
Well, we had one witness testify, Your Honor. And then the problem is that once the one witness testifies, it is the view of apparently the district courts and then certainly the ICA that trial could be going on now. And my client would have no.
But we're looking at your case, not a theoretical. I mean,
right.
I understand what your argument is. I may not agree with how you're articulating in terms of what constitutional principle. It seems to me what you're really advocating is it's a due process argument, not a speedy trial argument. I think what you're really stating is what could occur in this case is there could be unfairness to the defendant if the delay was unreasonable. But that's a different construct than you put forward and may not fit this case. But there is protection, I think, under the Constitution if the trial was still going, as you just asserted.
Could I ask you, in following up on Justice Pollack's question, Mr. Holcomb, could I ask you about the specifics of this case with respect to the timing? How do you respond to the point that, and correct me if you don't read the record this way, but the record seems to indicate that the defense had agreed to a continuance up to June. Well, after that, it was continued, I guess, to August. So why wouldn't that indicate that you felt that there was a meaningful portion of the trial, at least, and that you were conceding that and even agreeing that the case could be continued till June?
Okay, so what our position is that in the first we start with January, there's one witness, then we go to March. And in March, I had initially told the judge, hey, I'm going to be requesting a transcript. Sometimes those take a long time. He says, no, you don't get the transcript. Go get the audio and take notes, which is a different issue.
But did then, you say you were going to be requesting or you had requested?
I did request.
Right. I thought you had said you had requested hadn't received it yet.
For the March hearing, we had Officer Number 2, Brennan Besa, come and testify.
Okay.
That was the first of his testimony. I was then supposed to, at the next hearing, finish my cross-examination of him.
Okay.
And that's why I would need the transcript for that, in my opinion.
Okay.
So in other words, a delay could have advantaged you. I think that's perhaps a concern I have with your perhaps broad argument that any trial delay may result in a speedy trial violation because a trial delay may advantage the defense. I mean, there may be a fact that you can't locate a witness is, you know, being somewhere else, you can get a transcript. So it really depends on the facts of the case, which is, again, why I feel that this is really more appropriately a due process type of argument.
Very well.
Prejudice is a, you know, a requirement.
Well, I agree with you that due process certainly should be entailed in the analysis of what has occurred. What we seem to be talking about is the second Barker-Wingo factor, where we talk about the defendant's assertion of her speedy trial rights. So at the March hearing, it is correct and astute that, in fact, I had requested a transcript. This police officer saying he wasn't available until June, I think did allow me, in fact, to get the transcript for the next proceeding. However, I did not ask for a continuance, but I said, hey, we're going to be requesting a continuance. That was specifically denied. Before that, Ms. Alkier and I, on behalf of Ms. Alkier, had done a number of things to attempt to prevent the delay of the trial, including asking two or three times, I can't remember exactly, for a pretrial suppression hearing so that my litigating these Fourth Amendment constitutional issues would not then cause a delay of trial. We show up for trial, all those attempts had failed. We say, well, fine, we'll consolidate to try to get this over with. And then it doesn't conclude, and Ms. Alkier, importantly, doesn't have an opportunity to present her defense until 9 months later. So when we talk about asserting a trial, I would suggest to you that we did assert our right to a speedy trial in a number of different fashions. True, in March, I didn't say, well, we're not going to wait until June because this police officer is not available. And part of the reason, quite frankly, was I thought that might allow me to get a transcript. But I'm sorry, Justice.
I think, unless you want to finish your point, I understand your point in that issue. But I wanted to have you address, if you could, the issue with respect to the request that was made by the defense for the video, the police video that was taken of her on the night of the incident. And it's my understanding that a request was made by the defense within 5 days. So my question, Mr. Holcomb, is assuming that there is a tape, I would assume that your request for relief might be different than if it's clear in the record that there's no longer a tape and it was destroyed as sort of a routine exercise by the police. So I'm sorry about the long preface, but can you help me with the record? Is it clear whether or not the tape exists?
So what I had attached to my motion to compel was, first of all, the request to preserve that I had sent approximately 5 days after Ms. Alkier's arrest, saying, hey, we know you guys have this video. We also know if someone doesn't go and physically download the video, then it will be destroyed, much like the security camera at the 7-Eleven. Once so much data builds up, it overwrites itself. Then this is not a singular instance where I had been litigating the issue of video.
No, I assume you're building up to answering my question, which is, do you have a position as to whether this video exists?
I believe that it should, and I would rely on our prior litigation where I had submitted transcripts.
You're saying then that they have it, but they didn't produce it?
I'm saying that they should have it because I asked that they preserve it, and I had put in the record the
transcript. What was the representation as to why it wasn't being produced?
There was no representation. When these discovery motions were decided, the lower court said, I'm not going to rely on the state's memorandums in opposition because those were filed late, and then the prosecutor made no argument at all.
But it seems there was I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it seems there was testimony at the trial that the letter, or maybe it was the hearing before the trial, the letter that was sent by the defense requesting preservation of the tape was sent to the chief of police, and therefore it went to the wrong source in the police department, I guess. It was supposed to go to the receiving desk, and that seemed to imply that since the letter wasn't received,
okay, so
that it may have been destroyed.
If I may, Justice Wilson, what I believe that you are referring to now is the transcript of a prior proceeding that I had attached to my motion, where I had Barry Tong, who at the time was the sergeant in charge of maintaining and producing these videos, come in another matter before Alkier.
Yes.
And say, if he sends his request to preserve to the Central Receiving Division,
yes,
I will get it and I will preserve it. So in Alkier, I did just that.
I see. Okay,
so
thank
I
you.
Believe that it should exist based
what,
on
what the showing do you think the defense needs to make, if any, to obtain tapes of this kind? And
okay. So I would point the court to State versus Tattoo. And in Tattoo, we talked about the necessity to investigate and specifically rejected any idea that a defendant must show materiality before being permitted to investigate. The whole idea of an investigation is that there is a risk you might find things that you don't like. Okay? So I would suggest to you that the video, while we believe, well, it's at least potentially exculpatory, and we believe it would, in fact, go to mitigate what these officers are saying they observed about Ms. Alkier, we believe that that materiality showing should not be necessitated when this video, particularly in light of the fact the video can be downloaded on a disk, and now they mail it to me.
So what about Rule 16.1 of the Rules of Penal Procedure? Is that is your position that that's invalid or that we should interpret it in a different way?
I would point again to the language of Tattoo, which talks about these constitutional concerns override the requirements of Rule 16.
Well, Mr. Holcomb, in that regard, in terms of materiality, if you consider in Tattoo, and your interpretation seems to be consistent with Tattoo, that the concept of materiality doesn't apply when it comes to the right of the defendant to view the scene, even if the scene is under the control of a private entity as opposed to the government. Now, in Tattoo, that was a scene that was sought to be reviewed 6 months after the incident. Right. In this case, there is an effort to review a piece of evidence that shows the defendant within hours of the time that the defendant is alleged to have been intoxicated, correct?
Within.
So my question is, if there's no materiality requirement in Tattoo, how could there be a position that it's immaterial what a defendant looks like who's about to be charged with driving under the influence of alcohol when there's a video of the night of the arrest? How could that be immaterial?
Okay, well, I didn't mean to suggest Tattoo was that broad where there is just no limitation at all. But our position is this. So Ms. Alkier, once these police officers observe these so-called symptoms of impairment, if you will, they immediately arrest her, they drive her downtown to the police station, where it's videoed like Fort Knox. There's videos all over the place. So that's only minutes after her arrest. And what I have also attached to the motion is scientific articles that suggest that we would expect to see similar symptoms of impairment 10 minutes later, or however long it was. They don't just magically dissipate.
Well, so, let's assume then that it's the burden, if this is your argument, of the defendant to establish that the evidence is material of a video recording of the defendant on the night when the defendant is alleged to have been intoxicated and driving. Let's assume that there's some sort of burden on the part of the defendant. And in this case, assuming that that burden has been met and the evidence isn't available, that it actually has been destroyed as a matter, I guess, of a routine practice of the government, would your request for relief be any different with respect to what should take place in this case as to whether there should be a remand for a new trial or not?
Okay, so what I had anticipated this court doing is remanding it with instructions to determine whether it still exists. And then my plan is to...
Well, that's quite clear, but I am going to ask Mr. Fudo whether or not the tape exists. So would your position be any different if the tape doesn't exist?
Well, I should be permitted to then raise spoliation issues, particularly in light of my request to preserve.
And what would the remedy be for spoliation?
Well, I think that Ms. Alkire would be at least entitled to a new trial where there would be some presumption that, in fact, these symptoms were not observed, at least in that time period.
Isn't our law pretty clear that if evidence is destroyed where it should be preserved, that there's a negative inference from the destruction?
I think so.
Montefeo, there's several cases. I don't think it's...
Is a negative inference required or allowed?
Well, I think that I don't think it's required. However, I think that is the minimal sanction that should be imposed for such material.
What about the Marsland case? What's your, if you could just briefly address that, and then would you talk about the issue of the police officers' personnel records or information related to their credibility?
So Marsland, my problem with Marsland is that it does not address these constitutional issues at all.
It's a petition for writ of mandamus where you have to show a clear and indisputable right to relief.
Correct.
And no alternatives. In other words, these issues could be raised on an appeal, and therefore it's very hard to get a writ of mandamus.
I know that from experience. I have, on these impeachment materials, I have tried a number of times. The indisputable prejudice in Marsland was the state said, if we give them these disclosures, then it's a done deal. By the time we appeal, we've already given it to them, and so we have no relief, and we want relief now.
Well, what about the issue of impeachment materials on the officer? If you'd address that, please.
So this is something that we have also obviously been litigating for quite some time. The procedure that is employed now in the prosecutor's office is that they will send a letter to the bureaucrats at the police department and the police commission to say, is there anything dealing with truthfulness or veracity of these police officers, these specific police officers? Then they get a letter back, and they rely solely on that letter. Which our problem with that procedure is twofold. First of all, we do not believe that the police department or the police commission should be making the decision as to whether or not discovery should be given to the defendant.
Is the request, and especially, I guess I'll ask specifically about this case because that's what I assume in the record. It's one thing if you ask and the answer is there's no impeachment material. It's quite a different matter if the prosecutor responds, there are no records pertaining to this police officer in the, that the police commissioned. Wasn't it the latter in this case?
I didn't ever get the letters, but.
But didn't the prosecutor represent to the court that the individuals had no records, that these entities had no records on these individuals?
My understanding of that is responsive to her inquiry, which is the second problem that we have with the procedure. Their inquiry is limited to truthfulness and veracity. So not only is the HPD and the police officers and the police commission deciding whether or not information fits that criteria, but secondly, that is not broad enough to give us the materials that we are entitled to under a Brady Giglio type analysis.
So they're asking for something less than what Giglio and Brady would require?
I think so. Correct.
And what process would you advocate for, that the prosecuting attorney would be required to go to the police and review the records themselves, or to what extent would they be required to do that?
I think that is what has been employed in other jurisdictions, that the prosecutor is to review these police officers' personnel files to determine, in light of the specific facts of a specific case, whether or not any of the information that exists should then be disclosed to.
So in every DUI case, the prosecutor would, if there was a request, the prosecutor would be required to review the personnel and or police commission files of each police officer that was expected to testify.
Okay, I don't think it would be that complicated, because Cowles versus Whitley, that I have harped on in my briefing throughout this litigation, talks about the means to allow what you have identified to happen, which is to keep a database and track these officers and red flag them in their own files.
So, what did you request?
What's that?
What did you request, your specific request regarding the police officers?
I requested a full realm of Brady information. I think I can.
Well, what is that? Did you? Is that what you said? I want a full realm of.
No,
Brady
no, no. I requested very specific items from my discovery request, and I don't know if I can point to it quickly, but I believe it is paragraph 12 of the discovery request that is in the record.
Okay, and you're saying that despite your explicit, you have knowledge that the prosecutor then just said, just give me materials regarding truthfulness and veracity?
That's what she said on the record, yes.
She said that she didn't ask for all the things.
Well, so there was this, the arguing of the motion, the judge asked the prosecutor, do you have anything that's impeachment materials for these officers? She says no. Then they say, well, do you believe in your estimate that the prosecutor's office has done their due diligence? She says yes, and I say, wait a minute, Judge. I would like her to put on the record what she has inquired for.
What do you anticipate would be used for impeachment against a police officer in a DUI regard outside of truthfulness and veracity?
Okay, so there are a number of different issues, and I would point the court to the Mielke versus Ryan case out of the Ninth Circuit, where they talk about some of the broad nature of what Brady requires, and also United States versus Howell, where they say that Cowles versus Whitley requires any information that might provide an opportunity to attack the thoroughness or good faith of the investigation. So that would include abuse of power. If this my client is saying, I didn't voluntarily participate in this, or this, I think it's important to know if this police officer has a history of abusing his authority, insufficient training. We are able to conclude that this officer was or that this defendant was impaired by virtue of our having applied these field sobriety tests. Well, you failed the NHTSA field sobriety testing 5 times. I think that would be important to know. So those are just some examples of what types of information may be out there that the prosecutors aren't even trying to detect at this
point. So on every single DUI
every single officer, the prosecutor has to go down to the police commission and the police department, because they have two separate records, and review the entire employment history to see what the training was and how they did on training?
No, what I think that they need to do is, again, go and review it one time at least, and then keep a database.
So in other words, what that would really require is that the prosecutor's office would need to go down and review the files of all police officers that may testify at least once. And then HPD would have to probably transmit to the prosecutor's office every time there, what, any update as to the personnel files or any additional police, or the same for the police commission, because it would have to be both, right? Mm-hmm. And so the prosecutor's office would become a depository of all the personnel files and complaints with respect to all police officers also?
I think that they have to at least, I don't know if they are a physical depository, but I think that they are required to at least have access to that and keep a database so that the new prosecutor coming into DUI court can easily access this database and say, hey, this guy's got a red flag.
Well, wait a minute. When you say database, you're asking personnel records. You're not asking a database regarding infractions or anything. You want the complete personnel file. So you're not talking about a database. You're asking them to establish a personnel file for every police officer.
I'm asking that the prosecutor review the personnel file to determine whether there's information that should be disclosed. And then I'm not saying they should have to do it for every morning before DUI docket.
Mr. Holcomb, is it your understanding that the prosecutor has to review the files with the police commission in every single case where the defense is alleging that there is a history of misconduct that can include a lack of truthfulness? In other words, does the defense have a procedure that it is entitled to utilize to request from the police department records that pertain to the personnel history of police officers? Is that available to the defense in every case?
Not that I'm aware of. In fact, when the prosecutors send these letters and get a positive response back, the letters from the police commission and or the police department will say, we're not going to give you these records because they're protected by 92F, the IPA.
Yes, but there is a procedure, is there not, by which the defense can request such records. It's provided for in the rules of criminal procedure.
Request it from the prosecutor?
You can request the records of a police officer in a criminal case that may pertain to the truthfulness of the police officer. You can make those requests to the prosecutor, correct?
I did, yes.
Yeah, so this idea that it's burdensome for the government to have to respond to requests by the defense for records of misconduct of police officers has already been anticipated, right, with the rules of procedure and as well as the right to an effective assistance of counsel. You have the right to make those requests, do you not, on behalf of your client?
Absolutely. And moreover, Justice Wilson, I would point out to you that the black letter constitutional law out of the United States Supreme Court is, I don't even have to request anything at all.
Holcomb, yes. I want to make one thing. Justice Wilson asked you, is when you have reason to believe that a police officer is not telling the truth, there's a problem, but you're not asking it for cases in which you have reason to believe that you're saying in every single case the prosecutor has to go into personnel records, whether or not you have a, because you're conducting discovery.
Absolutely.
So you're just saying in every single case, not when you think that the police officer is being dishonest, right?
I think that's absolutely true.
Didn't just request truthfulness information. You requested the personnel files as well as any other documentation regarding the officer's misconduct.
Correct.
So that means all personnel files, all police commission files, and Which is actually, it's kind of interesting because my understanding is the response was that the prosecutor's office was told by the police commission and HPD that there were no records as to either officer. So I guess some review was made.
That goes back to the scope of their inquiry where they said, we would like you to give us truthfulness and veracity records, and then that's when they get the response saying there are no records.
So they limited the prosecutor's office, limited
correct.
The scope of your request.
Correct.
We've gone over quite a bit already, so
we have.
I need to give you some more double time, but
thank you,
Your Honor. Point, you should hear from me.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Fudo, Don Fudo, for the prosecution. Just in my opinion, two issues of first impression, new rule, 30 minutes. Can it really be accomplished? I just don't think so. But in order of priority, let me throw this out for the court with regard to the comment about whether it was harmless error. This is going to the alleged Tachibana error. Okay. What I kind of need this court to remember, that unlike a typical Tachibana situation, you had both defendant herself and counsel in an affidavit with regard to the motions, and then on the record during the trial say that she doesn't remember any details about the case, but for the fact that when the officer said one statement, she remembered she said a different thing and there was an expletive, I don't need to go into it. So to think now to remand for what? I'll just leave that at that.
I didn't hear you. Obviously, I didn't hear what you said.
No, I'll just leave that stated like that. You make your own credibility determinations whether if she suddenly remembers all the details, which counsel said she didn't, and he put that in a motion in the declaration of counsel. I don't know. It's mind-boggling. And then with respect to each and every motion, does the court realize that the district court started out each proceeding for the motions? Mr. Holcomb, do you have anything to add? No. Didn't subpoena any witnesses, didn't have any evidence to present, and didn't. And now all of a sudden we're here talking about a remand. That's not what Hearn justified.
Could I ask you about that, Mr. Kudo? Because I'm interested in your thoughts about the degree to which the defense is able to prepare their defense prior to trial with respect to this a relatively new technology, I guess you could call it, where there is a regular videotaping at the police station of various activities that are taking place. But in this case, I think it was pursuant to, and correct me if I'm wrong, regular videotaping that the defendant was videotaped the night that she was brought into the police station. So I wanted to ask you, in terms of the preparation of the defense with respect to the government's investigation or evidence, we clearly have established in the past, when maybe we didn't have the same technology, the proposition that if the government gets statements from witnesses, particularly from the defendant, those statements are available to the defense through discovery, correct? Generally speaking?
No, absolutely speaking.
Okay. And in this case, the government has created evidence as a matter of routine, but it appears that there is also a routine practice of videotaping over that evidence, so it wouldn't be available any longer. So what would you say is the point at which the government is obligated to provide that evidence to the defense, if at all, given the fact that it is actually direct evidence of what the defendant looked like soon after the alleged incident?
Okay, first of all, it's just got to be my age, but I'm going to say I kind of don't understand your question, but when you're using...
Well, let me just make it clear. Well, in this case, the defense, within 5 days, asked for the video, and I think it's a position of the government that it wasn't material. But I'm just curious, in your view, at what point would the defense have an opportunity to gain this evidence from the government?
Actually, it wasn't evidence. And number two, in response to your question, Mr. Holcomb, at the time the motion was heard, Mr. Holcomb knew it did not exist. That's what the court ruled primarily. It didn't exist.
So this,
it had already been written over. With respect to the evidentiary...
Within 5 days, it was written over?
How do we know it was written over? I mean, I thought...
Because of the attachments he attached to the motion.
But I thought that there was a transcript that indicated that there was a specific request, and you directed the request that it would be preserved. I mean, do we know for certain? Is there anything in the record from the police department saying this particular video was not preserved and no longer exists?
The record, the transcript to which you're referring, that was in file years ago. He attached that to his motion along with another letter. What both of those said is in District 5, Kalihi, 30 days, written over.
No, but, right, but we're saying in this particular case.
Right.
I think it's been established what the procedure is, which is why Mr. Holcomb requested it earlier and then requested it particularly to the Kalihi station. But do you know in this particular case whether, I mean, I understand what you're saying, logic leads you, but in this particular case, do we know that the tape doesn't exist?
Yes. It was.
So basically, the letter.
Wait just a minute.
What does the record show with regard to the existence of this particular tape?
Nothing. He presented no evidence. Nothing.
Wait a minute. There was. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
That wasn't in his. He asked for the tape, and he's supposed to say whether it exists or not when you guys don't give it to him?
No. He asked for a motion to compel the video.
Right. Well, right. But didn't he send a letter in asking that the video be preserved?
I'll say.
No,
he attached a letter. The letter was not just to the police department. It was to your office also. Yeah, so my question is, when your office receives a letter requesting preservation of evidence, what is your procedure?
I don't know that we've ever received a letter to preserve evidence because we don't gather evidence.
I'm sorry. Rule 16 is pretty clear that if there's... Even if it's not evidence that's in your possession, if you have, you can reasonably do something about it, you have some duties. So my question is, when you receive evidence, your office receives evidence requesting preservation of evidence that is under the control of the Honolulu Police Department, what do you do?
The deputies comply with Rule 16 and their burden, so whether there's a request, we're always going to turn over the evidence we have in our possession and in any other governmental agency that we can get. So when a person is initially, arrested in the field, we don't even have the case yet. So,
my question is then, in this case, right, since the letter went to HPD and to your office, and there was a motion to compel, what's the communication between your office and HPD as to the existence of this video? Are you saying that there was never even a communication
to see
whether it was preserved or not?
No, Your Honor, no. And that's not what the district court found either. The district court, when he's given the opportunity to elicit any evidence, he had nothing. So,
Mr. Fudo, how can he point to the lack, say he has anything? And further to your last answer about when the person is stopped, there is no case. But this is a DUI. So a case is made pretty soon after the person is stopped. I mean, she's taken down to the police station. They make a case. So 5 days later, by the time Mr. Holcomb has it, there's a case. And the person has already made a first appearance. The prosecution has already weighed, you know, it's been to court, and the prosecution is there also.
His letter cited to the district court case number, DTI 116.
Understood. But I think it's a very interesting analysis, and not one that necessarily appears in your materials, that as long as there's not a case from your point of view in terms of it actually being charged, that the evidence can be destroyed?
No.
Because that wouldn't apply to things like investigations of statements. Sometimes statements are taken before it's determined whether there's a case. So now it's your position that the record is clear that this statement's been destroyed. So let me ask you about body cam.
Your Honor, there's no statement that was destroyed.
I'm sorry, the video? I thought you said that the video was taped over.
Yeah, it's not a statement, Your Honor. There is no statement.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. Let's say the video. The video is no longer available because it has been taped over. Is that more accurate?
I asked you if the record disclosed the existence of this particular video. You said no.
No.
There's a transcript from an earlier proceeding which described a procedure which might have used to infer that the video was over.
Two attachments. Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. And that's what the district court was basing its ruling on.
I thought the district court said it didn't rule on it not being in existence. I thought its ruling was based on it didn't satisfy materiality standards or something like that. Is that right? I mean, I'm not sure. I'm asking.
No, Your Honor.
It denied it because it said it didn't exist?
Yes, Your Honor. Here, let me just quote it for you.
Yeah, go ahead.
There's been no showing in the motion that a video recording of defendant exists or that it is material, so I don't believe the move-on has met his burden at transcript docket number 25, January 10th, page 8, lines 6 through 16.
Okay, no, that's fine. Okay, so I'm going to skip over whether or not they made a sufficient showing as to whether it possibly exists, because there seems to me a lot in the record that indicates that it may have existed at least, and at least there was an attempt to preserve it. And even if it didn't exist, I think that the defense, if it could show materiality, would minimally, if it was destroyed, be entitled to some sort of inference of destruction. But let me ask you about materiality. Am I wrong about, and I'm asking for clarification, there was no intoxilizer introduced in this case, correct? Right? That's correct.
It's correct that it wasn't introduced, not that it wasn't taken.
That's what I'm saying. There's no intoxilizer that was introduced in this case. Secondly, I believe that the district court did not rely on anything from the field sobriety test. Is that right?
I think that's incorrect.
I thought he.
But the court at some point suppressed in the ruling indicated that it was not going to rely, the field sobriety test was not necessary. Is that misunderstood?
I'm not going to say misunderstood, but that little bit different than my recollection.
I thought the court decided it wasn't going. It granted the motion to suppress and wasn't going to rely on the statements.
Thank you. That's what it was. The statements. Yeah, it was a weird ruling on this. That any statements suppressed, but evidence of the FSTs definitely, the performance thereon, it definitely came in, Your Honor.
But did the court indicate its ruling whether it's going to rely on it or not? It's a somewhat separate question.
The only thing I can say to that, Your Honor, is I don't recall the court saying it wasn't going to rely on the evidence it allowed in. I just don't remember that.
But I think Justice Pollack's point is most of the evidence had to do with evidence of impairment that was observed by the officer. The officer testified about the impairment, right? The swerving. As opposed to scientific evidence.
Okay, as opposed to scientific evidence. Yeah, I guess, yes, that's correct.
Well, and the ICA said, based on the lack of evidence that any video existed at the time of Alkire's request, and the overwhelming evidence of impairment, so the evidence of impairment we're talking about was testimony, and if that's the case, why wouldn't the video be material? If the video showed the behavior of the defendant, and it was the behavior or the conduct of the defendant that was the basis of the finding of guilt.
If you could, if you'll stay with me for a moment. First of all, no evidence of what is the video capability at any of these stations, but for no audio. Now, why is no audio important? Because as this coast noted in Ferrera, or however the name is pronounced, okay, it's a divided attention, multitasking objective of FSTs. So, that being said, at the video, at the station, here's some of the indicia that they testify to. Red glassy eyes. Is there any way we can do anything but speculation that these cameras right here would show my eyes are red and glassy? Let's just say even if they are.
Okay, well, I'm following your argument that these cameras or any camera that's in the police station would not produce any material evidence just because of the nature of the way it's recorded? Is that
no, it? No, not any. If I can be allowed to finish, okay? And then another indicia that they observed, smell. Which of these pick up odors?
But doesn't that further make your point that this wouldn't be material?
If I can finish, yeah, I will show you that it's material, that it's not material. Then the swerving, there is nothing in the station where she's driving that would capture swerving. So a little bit of unsteadiness, if it were the case, or let's make it the best case for defendant. At the station house, even if she just sat right in front of the single camera with the field of frame, you realize the record said they keep a wide angle, right? Because they want to protect the privacy, and they want to be able to see a group. So what would that prove? She's not being told to do anything.
I can see you're making a very, shall we say, focused point that the nature of these videos wouldn't be material to
a
DUI
case.
Well, is it your conclusion that there might be some circumstance under which the recording of the defendant and the night she is arrested, given the nature of the recording, would be material? Is it possible?
Definitely. If we knew what the video recording capabilities were, there's no evidence.
So the defense has to come forward with that evidence instead of your position. They have to come in and they have to, subpoena or send investigators out to talk to the officer. How are they supposed to? Yes, they're
going to come forward. Well, okay. Let's be fair. I think at the very least, they shouldn't rely on testimony from two or three years ago for a station which she wasn't taken to be able to say that the videos definitively would have. And here's the key point: captured the indicia the officer saw: swerving, smell, red glassy eyes, and a little swaying when told to remain still. So at the video station, I'm arrested. Nobody's telling me to do anything. And even if they did, Your Honor, the audio, there is no audio according to him. So how would you know as a divided attention task, she's not complying, he or she is not complying? You wouldn't.
I think we get your point.
It's about materiality, which Justice Pollack said.
My follow-up question would be then, if she is bouncing all over the place while she's doing the FSTs, you're conceding that's material. Because your argument is, in this particular case, there wasn't stuff going on that the tape, that the video might reflect on. If she were, or the testimony was, that she was unable to do the FST, she stumbled, she fell, then I'm taking it you would concede that it would be material in that instance. That's where you're going with this argument, seems to me, but I'm just asking you.
No, I don't discount the possibility in a particular case, if the defendant is very unsteady on their feet in the field or whatever, and then they go into the station and they're unsteady on their feet, yeah, those compliment, but I've never seen a prosecutor ever try and bring that in, ever. So all I'm saying is, with regard to Justice Pollack's...
There's very little incentive for the government to try to bring it in, because the government is already have witnesses who are going to testify that the person demonstrated probable cause for an arrest, and they've been brought in to the station. So the government, that's why the defense wants that evidence. This person has been convicted of being unable to guard against casualty. That's what the government, that's what the prosecutor said, excuse me, that's what the judge found, and the court also found that it would make that finding without the field sobriety test. So to sit here and argue that a video that could possibly show this individual walking, standing, sitting, doing different actions and motions wouldn't possibly affect the defense, to me, is really hard to grasp.
The reason it's hard to grasp is maybe because, let's just say it's on me, but I'm thinking of the Trombetto U.S. Supreme Court case, which this court adopted in Montefeo, which says with respect to the spoliation issue and the constitutional, they said loosely called duty to preserve evidence, got to show materiality. It's materiality and bad faith.
And what does materiality mean, counsel? What does materiality mean?
Okay. Let me just read it for you because I don't want to.
Well, would materiality have something to do with the nature of the request? I mean, in this case, the prosecutor and the police are put on notice by a letter that, according to the defendant, there would be evidence that would be exculpatory as a result of the videotape. Now, I think you're saying that from the point of view of the prosecution that the letter was something that should not be persuasive because of the nature of the video. No, but I suppose if the defendant were to say in the video, I recall that there was action taken at the police station in which, I don't know, there was some sort of a disturbance that caused me to have to react in a certain way that would show that I was actually very sober. In your view, maybe that letter would make a difference? I mean, I'm still kind of unclear about, from the prosecution's point of view,
that's not
what's required.
This started with just addressing Justice Pollack's question where he skipped over the existence, and I thought now we were dealing with the precedent in this jurisdiction which says Montefeo, it's got to be bad faith and material.
No, actually, no. Montefeo clearly rejected the bad faith holding of Youngblood. That's pretty clear. But in addition, it appears to me that in Tetu, we overruled by implication the requirement of materiality because we said requiring a defendant to demonstrate that access to the crime scene will lead to relevant evidence on a material issue undermines the defendant's constitutional rights to effective assistance of counsel and to a fair trial. And we made it very clear that we were, to the extent that State versus Town said that discovery is limited to what is allowed under Rule 16, we're overruling that.
Okay.
So therefore, you know,
therefore, because
what I hear you saying is, I'm not sure why you wouldn't respond to the preservation request.
Your Honor, I'm not saying that I know the reason. I'm just saying that there's nothing in the evidence, there's no evidence in the record that allows me to answer your question, or your question.
I
understand that he says a letter was sent. I'm not disputing that. I understand that, well, I'll just take it on faith that there are these surveillance cameras. I understand that too.
Should we interpret the record then to mean that your office and the police make no record of the requests that are made to preserve evidence?
No.
I understand you're accepting the letter. So for the
I'm not disputing that a letter was sent.
Letter, not disputing the
yeah,
so
but
what exactly is the showing that the state says that the defense needs to make to have access to the films in this kind of context? We'll just summarize it.
What is the required showing? Okay, looking at Montefeo, unless you've overruled this, when the evidence doesn't exist, court said, if the exculpatory value is not known, it would...
This is destruction of evidence, correct?
Actually, just loss or destruction.
Loss.
It's not available.
Is that actually what the trial court found here? Wasn't the trial court here just saying There's nothing in the record to say there was a tape. That was his phone.
No, that's not what he said.
I got it in front of me.
So do I.
No showing in the motion that a video recording exists.
Exactly. At the point in time of the motion to compel, and the court was basing that on the attachments that Mr. Holcomb provided that said it gets written over in 20 to 25.
But he had...
I'm sorry. You believe that's what the court's finding was, it had been written over, as opposed to simply he didn't think there was enough of a showing that such a tape ever had existed?
The court wasn't saying it never existed. No. And I almost get the feeling that there is a lack of specific awareness of that request. When you have emboldened in that request to the police officers, this is not a discovery request, exclamation point. And then he buries within that letter, I think it's like 12 pages, rather than specifically identify it. And what is it that this beat cop is supposed to be looking for that he says might help the defense? I mean, if you could make it more vague, I'd like to see it. But something that vague, it's not screaming out, okay, here, get it. Doing all these things Justice Wilson said about all this, I'm sober and I'm in a... It just doesn't say that.
So that's an argument. I'm just trying to understand your argument. This is an argument. The letter itself wasn't enough.
No. Not saying the letter wasn't enough. I'm dealing with a situation now that's the facts of this case. The video was no longer in existence, okay? Precedent seems to say now we go to step two and determine, okay, what is the consequence of that? And, you know, the treacherous task of divining the import of materials whose contents are unknown and very often disputed. This is Montefiore. This is Montefiore, 71 Hawaii at 186. It's quoting the U.S. Supreme Court case that you folks adopted from Betta. So now we're engaged in almost 20 minutes of hypothecating about a video surveillance system of which we have no information to then make the leap of faith that we should have a negative inference? And no, there is no requirement in this jurisdiction about the negative inference. I've been riding that way for a long time. I know it comes from the Ninth Circuit.
Well, it exists when there's spoliation of evidence. I realized that it was actually Justice Wakatsuki's concurrence in Montefiore, mm-hmm. where he said that the spoliation instruction should go to a jury mm-hmm. as to a negative inference. Mm-hmm. That was, I think, the first time. I don't think we've held that in a criminal case. But in civil cases, we routinely hold that when there's spoliation of evidence by an opposing party, that the jury is to be instructed that the jury may draw an adverse influence. So are you saying that the standard should be lower in criminal cases?
No, I exactly accept the standard, Your Honor. But I'm sure then you're well aware the substance of the instruction depends on the circumstance. Because in the case that counsel cited, no, the California Supreme Court was not going to give the negative inference that you can infer that it went to the defense. What they said in this case is you are to understand a request was made, the evidence wasn't there, and let the jury draw its own conclusion. That's what I'm saying.
I'm still a little bit confused. Is it your argument that the duty to preserve would not apply here? Is that the state's argument?
No, it can't. The U.S. Supreme Court already said there is a duty to preserve. What they said loosely called duty to preserve. But they very much tempered it to make sure it was a reasonable duty.
So is it your argument then that the duty to preserve does not apply in these circumstances? Because I'm a little unclear
because
the memorandum in opposition to the motion to compel that the judge apparently disregarded, it was just based on materiality, and it was actually based on, you know, discovery is limited by Rule 16, even though in Titu we had already held that it's not.
You know,
and it cites back to town on that issue when we had overruled it.
Your Honor. I didn't write the memorandum in opposition, and I'm not here to defend it.
I'm trying to understand what the state's argument is. You're saying that you recognize there's a duty to preserve if there's a request, but is it your argument that for these types of videotapes at the police station, there is no duty to preserve?
No.
Okay.
No.
So then is it your argument that even if there is a violation of the duty to preserve, no spoliation or no adverse inference should be drawn?
No.
Okay, I thought you, I had heard you say that earlier. So what is your argument then?
Only with respect to this case and not all these sweeping first impression issues, there hasn't been a showing that it's material. The video would be material.
And I think that portion of Matafeo, I think, has been overruled by implication by Tetu, which says that you can't require a defense to show that it's going to be material.
Separate the two. I'm not talking about the request. I'm talking now, which I thought you understood, is the consequence of the violation.
If you would, in addressing the court, if you would be more respectful in your tone, I think that comment struck me as a bit disrespectful to the Honor.
I apologize, Your Honor. I apologize. And I knew I should have took my medicine before this argument, but I didn't. Okay. So,
while you're analyzing this, Mr. Fudo, would you give us some sense of how your office would see a body cam? Because, you know, we have these new technologies that have become quite current. So, let's say, for example, there's a body cam on this particular evening when the exchange took place, would you think that that would be material evidence? I mean, I understand that Tetu seems to make it quite clear that materialism isn't required if you're talking about viewing the scene, and in this situation may well not be applicable. But anyway, sticking with material, would that be material, a body cam?
Is a device, a body cam, material? Sorry, Your Honor.
No.
What I think I'm hearing you saying is, if there was a body cam, and if the body cam recorded video of, let's say, the incident, is there a possibility that that could be material? Is that what you're saying? Asking?
Well, I'm asking whether that might just, as a matter of fact, would be material. Okay. So,
gone to your time. I'm going to give additional time as I did for Mr. Holcomb. There are two other issues in the case.
Yeah.
Regarding discoverability of impeachment materials. Could you address the latter issue first and then move forward?
With respect to the latter issue, I don't think this court could have made it any clearer than in Piers versus News, Walton, and Tetu, that the Constitution of the State of Hawaii affords people a right to privacy in their personnel files. So, if the people in the state also include police officers, I think they have a right of privacy in their personnel files that doesn't trump the defendant's right to present a complete defense. But if we're trying to cobble together in this short time a procedure that would allow, and again, I hope the court is fully aware of the Brady request. It is voluminous, but as Justice Nakayama recognized, it starts off with he wants all the files, all personnel files. So if Justice Pollack and former Justice Akova's proclamation with respect to the importance of the right to privacy has any force at all, I just don't know how a prosecutor can call HPD or contact and say, I want all the personnel files for this officer, and then go to HPC Commission, I want all the personnel files for that, and then personally look at it. And I'm not dealing right now with the burden, because that shouldn't drive a constitutional right. But the justices, you've made so clear that without a warrant, you can't get it. Okay, I'm not thinking there's going to be a warrant here.
Your position is there's not, as Mr. Holcomb argues, a duty on the prosecutor to personally review the jury.
I couldn't find a single case that said they have to personally and individually, in a routine situation, review it.
I think there was some citation to case law saying that the prosecutor could not delegate, its duty to a third party.
Cases, first of all, it's not Supreme Court. It was egregious violations by the prosecutors where the court was saying this is willful suppression. So even in the cases that he wants to hold up, the California case, it does not contemplate that the individual prosecutor is going to procure the personal files of a police officer. No. In fact, that case said they're going to hold the prosecutor to the same burden as the defense. You got to go through the court. Those cases, so that you all know, want the court to review the files in camera. The information that's not going to be released, sealed on the record, the information that is will be in. And furthermore, how does the records get to the court? Well, in those cases, they say the custodian of records of that agency brings the record to the court. That person and anyone else that they authorize to be with them go back in chambers and have an in-camera video. I couldn't find any case he cited where, yep, they just ask, and then all the records are delivered, and then it's a free-for-all.
Very well. Do you want to address the Rule 48?
The Rule 48 is clear, as you stated. The rule says it's to the commencement. The case that he cited for the parables of evil, that's the Reinhart, California case, where the court said on the record with respect to California statutory Rule 45, I mean, it has 45 days, the court says the only reason he's going to start the trial and just have this pony show with just the jury there is because he wants to avoid the consequence of the rule. So in that situation, he said it's not meaningful. Also, he was not prepared to try the case as finality. He had committed no resources to try the case, and it was abundantly clear. So in that situation, I mean, I don't know most of the judges in this jurisdiction, but you have a code of honor, and to do some stunt like that, start a case, put on the record, they were doing this just to avoid the Rule 48 dismissal, I don't think there's any judges in this jurisdiction that would do that. And I don't think they would do it as a subterfuge and start it, and I know they wouldn't do it explicitly. There is absolutely, I have every confidence we do not have those kind of judges. They do their level
Well,
best.
Mr. Fudo, if you think that there's some proposition in the materials that would suggest that the defense is saying that the judge was engaging in subterfuge, it'd be interested to see that, but I don't think this record indicates that a judge was trying to engage in subterfuge. It's a judge attempting to handle his calendar. But nonetheless, that is often the case with speedy trial cases or cases involving Rule 48, right? You have a judge trying to do their best, but it just turns out that the actions are in violation of Rule 48. So I don't see a suggestion that this judge is trying to do something that is a calculated effort to avoid the rules, but did you see that in the material?
That's exactly my point. And you're on, I'll wrap this up.
Yeah, I don't think the defense is contending that the judge was engaging in a subterfuge.
When the defense keeps saying in his motions and in his briefs, he played no part in the delay. I mean, I'm sure the court is aware of the record. January 10th, agreed to the start of the trial, agreed to continue the trial to March 16th, agreed to continue the trial to June 10th. In the March 16th trial, when it comes to the end, you know what the judge said? We got to all get together, and I want to consider everybody's schedule. Defense counsel, my client, only afternoon. Defense counsel made it specifically known to the court he was going to order the transcripts, and if at the next trial setting the transcripts weren't there, he's going to ask for a continuance. He asked the prosecutor, what about your schedule? I have one conflict in Eva, that's it. Then he asked the police officer, well, I can't go for these 2 months because my mother is dying of breast cancer.
Yeah, but your recitation of the facts, is it meant to show that somebody was being insincere when they were giving evidence to the judge?
No, Your Honor, it's to address Justice Rechtenwald's question about the Rule 48 and commencement. And the inopposite cases he cites when there's not a meaningful commencement. And that's why I was telling the judge, as I previously stated, I don't believe the judges in our jurisdiction would do the stunt like the judge in Reinhart did. Moreover, the facts of this case with respect to delay, if you were trying to cobble together a meaningful opportunity, when the defense is continuing and agreeing to all these continuances, and then to say after the fact that he has no responsibility for the delay, the record is what the record is. I've been doing this so long, it's ridiculously inaccurate.
And then, anything further at this point?
Yeah.
Contrary
to defendant's assertion, the precedent in this jurisdiction does not say it. Rule 48 or either speedy trial is till the end of the litigation. Thank you.
Anything further at this point?
Thank you.
All right. So, welcome. Very brief rebuttal. We've got 15 minutes over our allotted time, so I'm going to ask you to keep it to 2 or 3 minutes now.
Very well, Your Honor. So the first thing that I would like to bring to your attention is the dates that the state is proposing to you. First of all, where Barry Tong, who is the video supervisor guy, I had attached his transcript from a previous proceeding. That previous proceeding occurred on February 16, 2016, not years before, as the state now alleges.
Is he the video supervisor of the Kalihi station?
No, he's the video supervisor at the Honolulu Honolulu Police Department Central Receiving Division. So he handles all of them.
So what do you mean handles all of them? Everything?
All the police stations. He was the guy in charge of the videos, at least at Kalihi and the main station. So he is the custodian of records, is how I got to be aware of him, for the videos.
He was called the custodian of records of the videos?
That's how I had initially become aware of him. I don't know that that's his exact title, but as the custodian of records, the person in charge of saving. And I will point to his transcript that I had attached, specifically page 18, where he says, if there was notice that came to us to preserve the evidence, I would have done so. I'm the sole person that saves those types of recordings.
So you sent the letter to him?
I sent it to Central Receiving as he had instructed in this transcript.
To Mr. Tong? You sent the letter to Mr. Tong?
No. He said send it to the Central Receiving Division, which is what I did. So that...
Any other points you'd like to make at this point, Mr. Holcomb? Yeah, I must move our proceedings along.
Very well. Do you have any specific questions for me that I can answer?
No.
Thank you.
No, this is not. Thank you. We're both of our